You're listening to Talking Baseball with Ed Randall, presented by MLB.com. He's Ed Randall. He's talking baseball. What more do you need?
Hi, everybody. I'm Ed Randall, Big Ed and Nora's baby boy, and welcome back to Ed Randall's Talking Baseball. The New York Daily News, in a recent editorial, asked the question, why do we set aside one whole month of every year to honor and celebrate the contributions of African Americans? The paper answered that the nation owes its citizens, black and otherwise, a Black History Month, because there is no other group of people whose lives have been, over the generations, systematically devalued, whose experiences have been purged from our collective historical memory. We honor Black History Month on Ed Randall's Talking Baseball with our guest who has done it all. All-star first baseman 5 times, drove in 90 or more runs in a season 5 times, won 7 gold gloves and a world championship, became an accomplished broadcaster who graduated to become president of the National League for 6 years. What an honor it is for us to welcome to the show Bill White. Great to have you. Thank you so much. What a resume.
Well, thanks, Ed. We haven't been on a while. I've been, away from the rat race.
I'm so glad to have you. Thanks. And yet, Bill, for all those accomplishments, your mom was mad because you didn't follow her instructions to become a doctor.
Well, yeah. I really didn't. She wanted me to go to school, period, and I wanted to be a doctor. But fortunately or unfortunately, I veered a little bit, and she was not happy with it. But everything ended up okay.
Did she come around in time?
No. I think she saw me play maybe a couple of times. She saw me play a couple of times. I'm from Warren, Ohio, went to Pittsburgh for a game, and she came down for that. And she saw me play one other time. I'm not sure she was happy.
You played in a time, and David Halberstam, the great writer, wrote about the 1964 Cardinals, which were imbued with great African-American players. Yourself, Lou Brock came that season from the Chicago Cubs, Curt Flood, Bob Gibson, of course. And then later, another 10 years after that, came Frank Robinson as the first African-American manager in baseball in 1975, at a time in which, Bill, more than 25% of the players were of African-American descent. Now it's about 8%. Why did it decline, and what can be done, in your opinion, to get it back to at least those levels?
Basketball and football. That's why we have a decline. Probably the major reason. They can see that basketball has changed. They can see these guys playing. I don't know how many teams they have, 30-some teams now. And it's funny, I thought the other day I watched Alabama play. Well, back during the football season. And I remember Bear Bryant and those groups down there. They had no black players. And now it's hard to find a player on those teams. They're championship teams, Alabama, Clemson, who is not. My hope, though, is that these guys, when they finish, the ones who don't make the NBA, will then get into something that they can go forward and be successful.
You played with these great players in the 1960s. A lot of people may not know that you actually started your career here in New York with the New York Giants, and then went into the military, missed an entire season. Now there's a novel experience, Bill. That doesn't happen today, nor do guys go off on National Guard duty like they used to, guys like Nolan Ryan and Bud Harrelson with the Mets and such. But you missed an entire season. And during that time, the New York Giants became the San Francisco Giants. When you came back to the team, they were on the West Coast.
Well, not only that, they had Orlando Cepeda, who was in the Hall of Fame. They had Willie McCovey, who was also in the Hall of Fame. But, it was an experience. A little kid coming in playing in New York, and I had a choice. I could the Giants wanted to send me to out to California to do what they called then an RFA program. It went for 6 weeks, and then you could come out and go, I guess, to meetings once a month. But I said, I'm going to get it over with. And actually, it was luck that I did do that. I went in and I did my 2 years. I came out, and I couldn't play with the Giants. I asked to be traded. Luckily, I went to St. Louis, a little short porch in right field, and that's why I hit a few home runs, only a couple hundred. But everything sort of fell in place. And it was a really a positive thing that happened. And these two guys, obviously Hall of Famers, good friends of mine, Cepeda and McCovey. We were together in spring training in the minor leagues, and we were together a while. And they deserved it, and I just appreciated getting the opportunity to play someplace.
You go to St. Louis, and then in 1964, the legendary collapse of the Philadelphia Phillies, 6.5-game lead with only 12 to go. They lose, you win on the last day of the season. You clinch against the Mets and then go on to play the New York Yankees in the World Series and beat them in 7 games with Gibson pitching the 7th game. What's a memory that has stayed with you from that World Series?
Well, the memory was a pop-up that Dal Maxfield caught at second base. We didn't play with our second baseman, Julian Javier, that whole season, that whole series, the 7th series. He was hurt, and Maxfield got the pop-up for the 7th out. Everybody jumped up and down, and we were world champs, and that was the only one that we played on. And that was probably, that could have been a thrill, yes.
And right after the World Series, and he told me this story, and I'm sure he told you this story. The great Yogi Berra, who was managing his first year with the Yankees that year, goes to Yankee Stadium after the loss of the 7th game, soon thereafter, expecting a contract extension, and instead is shockingly fired. And the Yankees replace him with your manager at St. Louis, Johnny Keene. What do you remember about that transfer, which was stunning here in New York on a number of levels?
Well, for us, we didn't do very well for probably, two-thirds of the season. And then John, of course, straightened us out, and we won. But during that first two-thirds of the season, when we weren't doing well, Augie Bush had brought in Leo Durocher and other managers, former managers, to run that ball club. Bush didn't think we were going to win. He had also fired Bing Devine and brought in another guy. And it got to a point where we just didn't know what was going on. All of a sudden, we straightened out a little bit, and we started hitting, and we started winning. And obviously, we won everything on, the last day of the season against the Mets. But it could have been a three-way tie for first base, I think.
Philadelphia, and Cincinnati.
Right. Yeah. So that was an exciting end of the year in 1964.
Who were your most influential mentors as you played?
I'd say Bob Hyland, who's got me started in radio in St. Louis. He's not with us now. Al Fleischman, who was head of Fleischman Hilliard. Johnny Keene, obviously. Harry Walker. We had a great experience. Harry, was an extreme segregationist when we first met, and we changed each other a little bit. And he helped me with hitting. And all my teammates, Gibson, McCarver, and Flood, Brock, and Grote. Mike Shannon. We had a good group. We had a tough group, a close group. And we had that group because in 1961, we integrated spring training in Florida, and we got to know each other. And we came close in 63, and we finally won in 64. People don't realize, but Florida was segregated back then.
Right.
And players couldn't stay. We stayed in homes throughout St. Petersburg, and the Cardinals stayed in a big hotel downtown. But we changed that after the 1961 season, I think, 61-62 season. Bing Devine put us all together. All these things happened because we had good people on the Cardinal team. We had good people in the Cardinal organization.
Bill White is with us, the great Bill White, with us on Ed Randall's Talking Baseball. Somewhere along the way, you told the legendary Harry Carey, when he broadcast the Cardinals, that he had an easy job. And maybe it was that offhand remark that ultimately led to your broadcasting career.
Well, it was. I was sitting around the dugout before the game, and Harry came in and was doing interviews, and I said, hey, that's a pretty easy job. And I think he got upset. And actually, he said, if you think it's so easy, try it. So I said, how do you try it? He said, make a tape. So I made a tape, gave it to him.
What did you make a tape of?
I think I interviewed a player and gave it to him. He took it to Bob Hyland, who then was running the CBS station in St. Louis. They did the Cardinal games at KMOX, and he listened to it, and Hyland said, come on in and see me. I went in, and we started everything. We didn't start broadcasting. He set me in with his meetings for his sales meetings, his PR meetings. He showed me all the broadcasting. He had me work with the engineers.
Wow.
Had me catalog records.
Wow.
He had me do a lot of things. And finally, he let me get on the air, and we had people like Jack Buck on the air. We had Harry Carey on the air. We had some very, very good people on the air, and they all helped me. So it was a good experience for me.
You said catalog records. We're doing a podcast. We got to explain to our audience what records are.
Well, you know, it was a great experience doing all those things, because I then learned what went behind a broadcast. I learned what went behind it, how to do it, and also how to broadcast.
And then after that, to Philadelphia, where you had played after the Cardinals traded you, and did television in Philadelphia after your career ended. And then from there to the Yankees in 1971, which I would think, working as part of a broadcast team, something you had not done before. Tell us how you got the Yankee job in 1971, how that came.
Well, I think... they say that I talked to Howard Cosell. Howard was down here doing a broadcast when he first started out, and he was becoming a big guy. And I think the Yankees were looking for a black broadcaster. Howard had helped me in the integration of spring training. He's the only broadcaster who, on the air, but on the air, Howard helped me. And so he found out, I guess, the Yankees wanted a black broadcaster, and I guess he said, why don't you get Bill White? That's what I understand. I really don't know that happened. But Mike Burke was then running the Yankees, and he said, hey, that might be a good idea. Now, when I got there, and Mike said we needed a black broadcaster, I was upset, because I said, hey, you need a broadcaster, period.
Good for you.
And he said, Bill, let me tell you something. There are a lot of kids on the other side of the river there over in Harlem. And if they see you broadcast, they say, hey, I can do that. And I think if you look at what's happening today with a lot of – with broadcasting open, I think Mike was right.
And I read somewhere about you in preparation for this interview that you said you never would have gone to New York were it not for a voice coach that worked with you.
Lillian Wilder. She had worked with me when I was down here at WFIL in Philly. I hadn't ever done television prior to coming here. And the station, Lou Klein, who ran the station, then sent me to New York to a voice coach called Lillian Wilder about twice a week. And she helped me learn to look into the camera, helped my diction, and helped me use action words. And that's finally... after I left KMOX, after I left WFIL, I went to New York, and all those things helped me learn how to broadcast, which, you know, my first broadcast, the home run was hit, and I said, the Yankees were playing Miami, they're playing the Orioles in Miami, and Phil had a date with Joe DiMaggio to play golf.
Phil Rizzuto, uh-huh.
And he left me, and I'd never broadcast a game. His job was to introduce me, my first broadcast with the Yankees. And all of a sudden, he left me. Guy hits a home run, and all I can say is, uh-oh. And I remember Howard Burke, B-E-R-K, who then was with the Yankees, said, get him off the air. But then Howard and they took me to 21, I guess, or whatever the name of that restaurant is, and they brought in Joe Garagiola and a couple of guys, and they said, hey, listening to you do a broadcast sounds like a fire drill. He said, this is what you got to do. And that's how I learned how to broadcast.
She taught you, your voice coach taught you so much except how to keep Rizzuto focused for the nine innings that he sat beside you, or seven innings on the home games because he had to leave to go beat the traffic, as they joke about. But you guys were tremendous together. And there's a story that sometimes on his scorecard, if he wasn't paying attention, he would write WW.
Yeah. He would. I would leave every once in a while, maybe to go to on the TV side because we switched back and forth, or I had to go other places. And I came back once and I said, "Phil, let me see your scorecard. I want to find out what happened." And so he had 6-3. That's a short to first, and maybe a 4-3 or whatever, second to first, and then a WW. We put these down so we can recap the inning. And I said, "What's this WW?" He says, "Well, I wasn't watching." I told that to Drysdale, and Drysdale used that in his speeches. Don Drysdale, of course, used that in his speeches later on. But, yeah, Phil helped me. He did a lot for me, in addition to allowing me to work more innings than I should have, which allowed me to improve. You know, once thundered or lightning, he was gone. But we had so much fun. I really missed him when he left us. Mm. And it was just, it was a loss. It was a personal loss.
There was there's a blooper reel, which I'm sure you've seen, of you guys doing the stand-up open to a Yankee game. You're on the road, and he starts talking at the top, and he says, "I'm Bill White."
That's probably one of the few times he called me Bill.
Yeah.
He never called me Bill. He always called me White.
He always called you White.
Well, he's a super person, super, super person.
And you spent from 1971 to 1988 with the Yankees, and yours is the voice we will hear forever calling Bucky Dent's home run. And Bill, it is amazing how a broadcaster becomes identified with a historical event. Yours is the voice. You go Yastrzemski as if you're waiting for the ball to come off the wall, and it doesn't. And you've seen Yastrzemski's knees buckle in left field, and Bucky Dent has hit a home run for the ages, and there is your voice accompanying it.
Well, I haven't heard it often. People tell me that, but I can't get that station down here, or don't get it. But, I'm going to call my agents and see if I find out why I'm not getting residuals.
After the 1988 season, you were offered the National League presidency, and you turned it down. Give us the turn of events.
Well, I turned it down the first time because I'd gotten a phone call from Peter O'Malley, who was head of the search committee for the National League. They obviously wanted a black guy, and I think we had three or four people who were considered.
Was his call to you completely out of the blue, or had
yes.
you?
Yes, it was out of the blue. I had come back. I had a meeting in New York for some reason. I came back, and the phone rang, and it was O'Malley said, "We'd like to interview for the job of National League president." And I said, "You know, you're crazy. I'm going to leave a job where by then we're only doing 60 Yankee games a year on television. We did them all on Phil and I did them all on radio, but we're only doing 60 on television." And every once in a while, I could just take off and go to Alaska and fish a little bit, and maybe if we were on the West Coast. And also, we did less games on radio. I don't think we lost the radio, and I was only doing 60 games on television, I think. I forget what year that was. So sometimes, if I had a few days, I'd go to Alaska and fish and mm-hmm. maybe meet the team wherever, in Seattle or L.A., whatever. And I was also doing some work for CBS Radio, so I had a full plate, as they say. But you're right. Well, first I said, no, I don't want to do it. I got a nice job. I work 60 days a year. And for some reason, he called me back. And I said, well, I'll try it. I'll go up and interview. And I went up and interviewed, stayed there a couple hours, and I left. And then I went out to St. Louis to give a speech for Al Fleischman. Al Fleischman, who would help me out in St. Louis. And I got a phone call. He said, "Hey, we'd like you to take the job." And I said, for some reason, I said, "Yes, okay, I'll take it," without even thinking the second time. And we stayed there, I guess, 5 years. One of the things that I'm really proud of is our experience. expansion when we went to Denver, where I played, and knew that Denver would make an excellent franchise, and also because of the makeup of the Havana or the Miami area, I felt that that's where we should go. So obviously Colorado was very, very successful. I think those are the two things that that I enjoyed while I was with the National League.
Adding the Rockies and the Marlins under your watch, it was such a great thing for baseball, Bill, to have you as the president of the National League, symbolically and otherwise.
Well, I'm not sure about the symbolism of it, but the players probably didn't like it because I had to find some of them.
Were you tough?
Yeah, I was tough. But, you know, when you're finding a guy who's making $100,000 to $200,000, $300,000 back then, and you find him $50 or $100, you know, they didn't like to pay it. But it wasn't much. But we had some fun times with that.
What do you think when Major League Baseball decided to fold the league offices into Major League Baseball and no more league press?
I didn't like it, and they knew I didn't like it, and I did stay an extra year. At the end of 4 years, I said, I've got enough. You know, I'm living down here in the country, and I got to stay in New York four or five days a week and fly all over the place. And when they decided to combine the leagues, I am still an American National Leaguer. And I think that it was important then for baseball to have an American League and a National League. They are successful with what they've done now, so it must have been the right decision. I didn't like it, and I left. I stayed another year after we lost our commissioner. And but other than that, I left early because I thought they were going to get a commissioner. We were out in Chicago to vote on one. They decided not to. So I came back home and I said, I've got enough. And I left in the middle, I think, of that fifth year.
One of the reasons, if I can editorialize, why you will always have my undying admiration is because you never adopted the designated hitter. I must tell you that I believe that the decline of Western civilization, Bill, can be traced to that moment when Ron Bloomberg of the New York Yankees stepped into the batter's box in Fenway Park. You were there in April of 1973, or your friend Orlando Cepeda was going to serve for the home team that day as the designated hitter for the Boston Red Sox. I believe that this is criminal.
Well, you know, it's baseball's they think they're modernizing, and it's modernized, and you know, they're making more money than they ever made. Players are making a lot more money. Owners obviously are making a lot more money. They wouldn't pay the players. I don't know if it's because of the DH, but I obviously still am not in favor of if you can swing a bat, you can put on a glove.
Bless you. Your mom would be very proud of your life.
I think so. I know she would be. I know she would be.
I am so grateful and honored to know you and have you on the show. So that'll do it for Bill White and myself on MLB.com. If you're on the move, thanks for the ride, and thanks for listening to Ed Randall's Talking Baseball.